Welcome to the WP Tonic This Week in WordPress and SaaS podcast, where Jonathan Denwood interviews the leading experts in WordPress, e-learning, and online marketing to help WordPress professionals launch their own SaaS.
Welcome back, folks, to the WP Tonic This Week in WordPress and SaaS. This is episode 906. We've got a really great guest. I've been really looking forward to this discussion. We've got Georgina Laundy from Forget the Funnel. She also is the author of Forget the Funnel book. She knows everything about funnels, about not using them. It's going to be a great discussion. I think she's up for it. She seems to laugh at my jokes. So that's always, I get a lot of, I'm very English, even though I've been living in America for almost 18 years. A lot of my guests just don't get my English in, Georgina. Bless their little hearts. So, Georgina, would you like to quickly introduce yourself to the listeners and viewers?
Sure. I'll try to do it quickly. Yeah, I have been in some shape of marketing for over 20 years now. And I have been dedicating my last tool. Maybe it's like, we're going on like 13 years dedicated to B2B SaaS. So as a marketer, very customer focused type of marketer, when I discovered the recurring revenue model of software businesses, I fell in love with it because I knew there was a role for marketing post-acquisition. I knew that marketing played a massive role in generating revenue. And so I thought, these are my people. And I kind of never looked back. I love SaaS and I love marketing. I love tech and startups. That's me.
All that good stuff. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I've also got my fantastic co-host, my patient co-host, Kurt. Kurt, would you like to introduce yourself to the new listeners and viewers?
Yeah, my name is Kurt Von Onen. I own a company called Manana Nomas. I also work directly with WP Tonic and the good folks at Lifter LMS for learning.
All right. He's got some really interesting questions for you, Georgina. Oh. He seems more up for it than me. Yeah. I'm not letting him off the hook, actually. But before we go into the meat and potatoes of this great show, I've got a couple of messages from our major sponsors. We will be back in a few moments, folks.
Tired of hosting providers that can't handle high traffic loads? Convessio is here to help. Our platform can handle any amount of traffic, all without slowdown or crashing. With immediate Slack support, performance optimization, and a team that thrives on resolving technical challenges, your e-commerce business is in safe hands. Learn more about Convessio at convessio.com.
Hi there, tribe. It's Jonathan here, and I want to tell you about OmenSend. OmenSend is a great plugin that delivers SMS messaging and email messaging to your clients. If you're building a woo solution for your client and you're looking to provide a SMS functionality for them and great email, why don't you look at OmenSend? Got a great special deal. You can go to wp-tonic.com/deals and they're offering 30% off the first 3 months. Plus, if you need any technical help or a migration, they're offering almost $1,000 to help migrate if you've got a group of clients that are looking for this type of service. It's a great offer. They're a great company. I highly recommend them to you. So, like I say, go over to the deals page on the WP Tonic website and you'll find more details there. Speak to you soon, folks. Bye. Coming back, folks, I also want to point out we've got some great deals from the sponsors, plus a curated list of the best WordPress plugins and services for the WordPress professional. You can find all these goodies by going over to wp-tonic/deals, wp-tonic/deals, and you'll find all the goodies, all the free goodies there. What more could you ask for? Probably a lot more, but that's all you're going to get from that page. I'm sorry to disappoint. I've made a career of it, but there we go. So, you're already wondering why you came on this show, aren't you? You know, but it's going to get worse as it goes on. It's going to be memorable, though.
Okay.
It's not going to be one of those interviews that you forget like 5 minutes after it. So you wrote the book, which is only a slight undertaking. I think going to the dentist in some ways is better than writing a book, I've been told. So only a quick question. What made you write the book, and what do you think are one or two of the major misunderstandings that you wanted the book to get across to people around funnels and misconceptions around growth strategies in general? Only a small question.
Yeah. The ethos for the book, the ethos for our business, honestly. So Forget the Funnel started as a content project between Claire Sollentrop and I, really to help tackle the stress, the misunderstandings, the underrepresentation, undervaluing of marketing in tech and those marketers in tech. That was really our sort of starting ground. We had both been in-house, we'd both experienced it, and we were both receiving a lot of, after we left our in-house roles, receiving a lot of communication and emails from founders of companies who were like, we need somebody with this marketing experience. My marketing team isn't, cutting it, and they don't get it, and we need somebody, experienced. And what we realized was that marketing in tech is very misunderstood, often seen as a cost center, often seen as the arts and crafts department, not always taken so seriously, a lot of people undervalued, underpaid. And so we sort of went into this with we've got to help these in-house practitioners. And one of the most effective ways to help these practitioners gain buy-in with their leadership teams was really to arm them with data and arm them with customer data that these companies could then leverage to build growth strategies around, where their ideas or their boss's ideas or the board's ideas weren't, necessarily that marketer wasn't going to be that order taker anymore. That marketer was finally going to be in a position to see things strategically, see things holistically, not have to guess, not do the spaghetti at the wall type of marketing. I say marketing, but obviously this also applies to product marketing. It also applies to product growth and growth teams that all think about, these aspects of growing, companies, particularly SaaS or recurring revenue businesses. A lot of these people, unfortunately, it's misunderstood what they do. They are underpaid, and they are constantly fighting for their right to be in the room. And so we get into this trap of, we just got to prove that we're doing something. And so we end up marketing for marketing's sake. It's tactics over tactics. But we really wanted to help folks get out of the weeds of execution, think strategically and holistically about marketing and the customer experience and conversion rates. And the best way to do that is customer research, and then operationalizing that customer research with customer journey maps and KPIs and things. So that was where Forget the Funnel as a brand sort of came from. And then eventually, as Claire and I worked together on mutual projects with companies, we realized there's a framework here that is actually applicable for lots of folks, either that we work with or that want to do it themselves. And we knew that there was a book in here. So that's what led us to read the book. It's a very short, practical sort of how-to guide, so that it's not theoretical. It's very, there's a way to go about this. Here are the specific step-by-step. There's even a 100-page workbook with templates and cheat sheets and checklists and all kinds of stuff. So it's really, really practical.
Well, sounds fab. I might buy it. I'm a dyslexic. So for me to buy a book is a rarity.
The audio book too.
Yeah. But this is my personal take in it. I think there's many facets to where we find ourselves. I've listened to quite a few of your interviews and listened to a few of your podcast episodes. And also you've been on Rob Rowling's, a personal friend of mine. and I really enjoyed your discussions with Rob. But I think it's a bit of a witch's brew. I think it's, there's the element, and in the title of this interview, I've had a little pop at Russell Branson, bless his heart. Just to get a bit of interest in it. But I think there's a real, you know, it's all in the funnel for a lot of people, though, getting the right funnel. And then there's the element of affiliate marketing as well. In the WordPress, in the lower SaaS, it's all about affiliate marketing. And then you throw in programmatic marketing, i.e. Facebook or Google Ads, where it's programmatic kind of marketing. You put in so much and you get so much back. It's easy-breezy marketing. So why do any market research? You know, that's just a waste of time, is it? Understanding your customers or needs. You don't have to bother. You know, the affiliate and the Facebook ads will just do it. But I think a lot of people think in that way, don't they?
That they can just experiment and put something out into the world and get feedback that way?
Well, you just leave it to the affiliate manager and the person in charge of the Facebook adverts.
I am not as close in the affiliate space, I will admit. I have treaded quite lightly there when I was in-house. I'm not a big fan of that strategy for most companies, because I think that most companies have an opportunity to go direct to market themselves if they really understand their customers. Not to say that affiliate isn't a cool way to add fuel onto that, but you have to have the foundation in place first. And that's really where I would go to the answer for this. And it's what you're describing is the same thing as an in-house marketer at a SaaS company who's desperate to show value and show numbers and just tries to drive up traffic, right? And prove that the website grew traffic this month over last, regardless of whether or not it actually led to revenue. And sure, you can market that way. And many, many, many do. But it doesn't last very long. And you will have short stints at whatever companies or brands you're working with because it rears its ugly head. And it has been rearing its ugly head even more so in the past few years as the cost to acquire a customer has skyrocketed. Advertising is, it's, I would consider like affiliate marketing, the thing you do at the end after you've got the fundamentals in place and a great way to add fuel to the fire. There are certain situations where I do appreciate paid channels for early stage where you're trying to validate. So let's say you've done some customer development, you have a hypothesis about the offering and you want to put it into the market and get that feedback back from the actual market and see if there's a willingness to pay. That's a great way to validate any customer development work that you've done. But it is not a long-term solution for growing your product, not in the most cost-effective way. At a certain point, it stops paying off, right? Like you can be successful with it in the early days and then eventually your ROI will drop. The cost to acquire those customers will just keep going up. And you are not going to get your biggest bang for your buck because you don't even have the fundamentals in place. So anybody who's doing sort of spaghetti at the wall style marketing like this, what I always recommend to them is find out what was the situation in the context in which your customers made a decision to switch from what they used to be doing to your solution. What did that day look like? What solution were they firing in order to look for something new? Having that context, that understanding of that pain, that struggle, that previous solution, their anxieties, their motivations, knowing all of this will make not only your positioning and messaging on your website better, your emails better, but your advertising better. You'll better equip any affiliate marketers that you have out in the world. If you have that sort of deep intel about the problem that you're solving, you're not selling a vitamin in today's market, you're selling a painkiller. And so if you don't understand what that painkiller is that you're selling, you are throwing money down the toilet.
I totally agree with you. And I think Kirk works with me on my company. And I think he knows that I really sometimes seem to be in pain, don't I, Kirk, as I discuss my lack of really understanding our customers. But over to you, Kurt.
You know, Georgiana, as I listen to you talk, my own brain goes between two extremes. And I think of, so people that are listeners and viewers, right? So I think of designers and agencies and small, some of these folks are still in like a perpetual startup mode, and they're not even sure who their avatar or customer really even is. They don't even really understand what their actual offer is to be able to take that leap forward and do that customer-led pathway, right? And then I think about the other extreme where I've worked in the corporate world where marketing and sales hated each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, they might have gone to the same meetings, but marketing was marketing and sales blamed marketing because there weren't enough leads, and then marketing blamed sales because they weren't closing based on, you know, the traffic. Mm-hmm. And so for these people that are in the middle of my extreme thinking, where does the traffic even, because we're making the assumption that there's traffic, we're making the assumption that there's customers to play with, but we have to get them like going first, right? How does all that get started? And then how do we convert that to a customer-led modality?
So it's a good question. And it's a lot of people, I think, struggle with that, where they're like, well, we're not getting enough customers. We're not getting enough traffic. So what is customer research going to do for us, given that we don't have enough right now? We just need more. And then when we get more, we'll do customer research. That's classic. And what I would say to that is, I mean, the answer is different depending on your stage of growth, right? At that, the lower end, the earlier stage, the answer is very, very different than the folks that are in the middle. And then it's very, very different when you get to the, you know, higher end of the market. But the answer will always come back to, do you have anybody today that is happy with what you're doing today? Because if your goal is revenue growth, then that's the people you tap into, because they're the people who have put money where their mouth is. They've made a decision to choose you over all the other options. They should be happy with your solution as it exists today. If you have anybody that falls into that category, they are like liquid gold to you. What is inside of their head is worth so, so much. Again, even if it's only, I would say, a handful. So that sometimes we're working with companies, and we work with B2B SaaS predominantly. We stray sometimes, but predominantly it's B2B SaaS. We go from all kinds of extremes. Sometimes we're working with companies that have hundreds of thousands of low ACV customers. There's a certain way to tap into that ideal customer to learn. And then we're also sometimes talking with companies that are more sales-led. They sell into enterprise. They've only caught a couple dozen customers in their sort of, you know, their book of business, so to speak, which is kind of similar to that early stage that you were describing, where somebody's, you know, newer to the game. They haven't even fully wrapped their heads around what they're doing yet, but they do have a couple of happy customers. If you're in that situation, you've got folks to learn from. It's going to come down to, how do you run that research in a way that gets you the insight that you need to help you figure out what is the value that you bring to them actually? What's the problem that you help them solve, which we've already talked about? What words do they use to describe their pain, your solution, right? What is that better life that you've created for them? Because if you can have that understanding of a few of your customers, you're going to start to pattern match across those few customers. You're going to say, oh, that's the tie that binds these customers together. And that will help you figure out your positioning and messaging. And if you can get your positioning and messaging locked in, everything else becomes a lot easier. All your marketing will work more fluidly. Your team will be better equipped if you're in a situation where it's a team and you've got, you know, customer success folks or sales folks. They will all have a better understanding of what you're doing. And that greases the wheels for more customers coming in. And then, of course, the obvious thing that I would advocate for is doing it again, not too long later, because things change over time. And this type of research is, I'm not necessarily an advocate for like stopping everything and doing, you know, research every couple of months. But if your product is evolving quickly, if your market is evolving quickly, if your competing landscape is evolving quickly, if your team is evolving, people coming and going, then you're in a position where you need to sort of democratize this understanding of your best customers so that, you know, you can build experiences that are actually going to resonate with your customers today, with your offering today, in the market today.
in your, I have to ask another follow-up because your answer, your response got something else going. You said identify that common tie between the customers. And what's jumping in my brain right now is how often is that common tie just a complete surprise or mystery to your customer, right? Like they're like, I didn't even realize that's what my offer was. I didn't even know that's what I was selling.
A lot. I would say almost every time. So, I mean, I've got a bunch of examples. I'm going through them in my mind, thinking which one would be the most helpful to sort of talk through. But we worked with I'll call it a membership site recently. So that might feel like a relevant example here. I won't name them, but essentially they've got what you would expect, a hybrid of a membership site and content, and tons of traffic. So they were doing a really great job on top of funnel. The founder of the company, you know, tons of thought leadership out there, quite well known. But what they were challenged with was not only signups for their membership, but retention and engagement inside of their membership. So they could get people through the front door, but they couldn't get people to actually hit that aha moment and start to really invest. And they were seeing more attrition than they thought they should see. So with this group, they had, you know, a small team. They had a, you know, lots of conversations happening with customers. It's not like they didn't talk to customers. They were having regular conversations with customers. The problem was it was disjointed conversations. One person was having a conversation over here about one topic, another one over here about another topic. And though they thought they had a pretty good holistic understanding of their customers, when we actually did it in a more formalized, like conducted real research in a more formalized way, we were able to provide them with insight into the groups that actually are represented within their larger customer base. And we identified three jobs to be done, so to speak. So we really lean on the jobs to be done methodology and approach for the type of research that we do. I can get into why we do that, but the TLDR with this example is that what we helped them identify were these three different segments of customers that come through the front door, use different language, are solving a different problem, are at a different stage in their career. What resonates with them from one to the other is completely different. And so what is really powerful for them to then implement is, yes, they've got to come up with a high level messaging and positioning that appeals to all. They can decide which one they really want to lean into, which they think represents their future opportunity. But then in addition to that, to take advantage of the revenue opportunity today, they can offer an onboarding that is segmented and more personalized. So they can ask them a question like, which best describes what led you to sign up today? Simple drop down that describes one of these three scenario offers an other, of course, right? In case, you know, you capture other situations and then offer them a much more personalized onboarding so that we make sure we're hitting the aha moments for the right folks at the right time. We're using the right language. We're describing the appropriate pain that they're experiencing, the appropriate better life that they're looking for. So it just fuels this like much more resonant messaging that obviously will help with conversion rates. And this is true of an onboarding experience, but it's true of marketing experiences as well, right? You would want to think about ways, and they will be thinking about ways because this is quite recent, different types of marketing campaigns that would appeal to those different audiences. They had never thought about the different watering holes these three groups of customers might hang out in. They'd only been thinking of the ones that encompassed all, right? So now they get to think through, oh, there's, you know, certain podcasts that appeal to one of these groups, or, you know, one of them is more offline. And so we should do more offline advertising to that group, or, oh, actually getting in universities is more appropriate for this group. Yep. And they can make much more strategic decisions about their outward marketing as well. But a really key part here is that you don't add on that top of funnel marketing until you've got your house in order. Once they get their house in order, that's when they're going to go out and bring more people through the front door. Otherwise, they're just bleeding money, right? Like, you're just throwing money away, especially if you're spending on that marketing. You're throwing that money away if your website and your onboarding experience isn't actually going to convert. You're just going to, it's a leaky bucket.
All right. Well, thank you. Jonathan?
Yeah, I totally agree with you there, actually. I'm going to On to the next.
You sound question. Surprised, actually.
That's just my English. Okay. I'm taking notes of it. All right, dude, I'm surprised by it. I'll be here every day. On to the next question, and it's covered in your book, actually, but I don't guarantee any originality in this interview. But I thought it was, because I know a few people are going to be thinking this, so I think we should discuss it. So it's the famous Steve Jobs quotation. Some people say, give the customer what they want, but that's not my approach. Our job is to figure out what's going to want before they do. I think Henry Ford once said, if I asked customers what they wanted, they would have told me a faster horse. So Basically, the intellectual argument towards your approach is that basically asking a load of people what they want and delving into their needs and that is great, but you're just going to end up with a better horse because they don't know what they're really looking for. So asking a load of people what they really want is a waste of time because they just don't know. So what's your response? Because I know you have got your response in your book.
Yeah.
That argument.
So a couple things. One is that Henry Ford never said that. It was in an Adweek magazine article, I think from 2001. He never actually said it. Actually, he was quoted by Dale Carnegie as saying the complete opposite. But the other thing is that the premise of that is you're not asking your customers what they want. And we haven't talked about this very much, but you're not asking them, would you rather A or B? You're not asking them, you know, what do you think this is worth? You're not asking them, do you like this feature more or that feature more or why, you know, you're not asking them what they want. You're asking them to describe for you what was going on in their world that led them to need a new solution. That has nothing to do with you. Right? What solution were they struggling with before? Nothing to do with you. You're not asking them what they want. You're asking what happened. You're not asking for them for their opinion. You're asking for the documentary, the chronological order of events. Now, if you can have enough conversations with enough customers about this chronological order of events, then you're going to start to be able to pattern match. But there's a very distinct difference between asking a leading question like, what do you like more? Or what do you want? Or what is this, you know, willing to pay? Which are very closed questions, and asking open questions, which is what was going on in your world when you first realized that you needed a solution like ours? What was the solution? What was it that was painful about your previous solution? When you started looking for a new solution, where did you go? Who did you talk to? Once you discovered us, what was it about our solution that convinced you to choose us over the other options? Once you started actually using the product, where did that, did you have an aha moment that led you and motivated you to keep going? Were there any deal breakers in this decision? Were there any anxieties? Now that you have our solution in your life, you know, what are you able to do now that you weren't able to do before? Nowhere in there are we asking them what they want. We're asking them to tell us about their experience. Once we've had those, that's very jobs to be done. That's why we love that approach. By the way, I will say there's a lot of really, really, I don't know if I can swear. There's a lot of really
No, I swear all the time, so go ahead.
There's a lot of really, really shitty research going on in the world and people who don't know.
You don't say. I'm stunned.
And it takes a long time and it's super expensive and it ends up not being helpful because it's not actionable. This type of research that I'm describing is getting the critical context that your customers were in when they made a purchase decision, and then basically figuring out like, okay, now that we know what these amazing customers, because these are your amazing customers, you're not talking to customers who churn, you're not talking to target audience that hasn't made a purchase decision yet. You're talking to your customers who have put money where their mouth is and that experience value with your product or your solution today. That is your best source of truth for this. And if you can identify what that experience is for them, you're going to be able to reflect it back to get more customers like them. It's like the customers you want to clone are the ones that you want to learn from. So if you can get that intel, it's got nothing to do with faster horses. It's completely about what was going on in their lives and that there's sort of psychographics of how they made decisions, not like, we don't care about personas, demographic data, don't care. I don't care about even company size or industry, although sometimes that will obviously impact the buying experience and vertical can and an industry can impact voice of customer, of course. But fundamentals in place first. What is the problem that we're solving for our customers, that there's urgency in their life to solve, that they have a willingness to pay to have it solved for them so that we can reflect it back to them and show them that we can solve this problem for you?
Yeah, my response to what you're saying is, first of all, I don't see it as a binary situation, a 0-1 situation. Number two, it's funny that Steve, but obviously Steve was an extremely complex individual. Obviously the iPhone, obviously you have the history of the Macintosh, but let's move forward to when he came back, the iPhone. The iPhone wasn't a revolutionary product in some ways. It was taking certain feature sets, which competitors who were established for some strange reason really didn't listen to users. And these certain feature sets, Steve was religious that the product had to meet to its user base. So it was user. But what I think he was talking about is, I think I'm correct about this, but I might be wrong because it's in my memory. Is this, I think it was the Ford Corporation when they were building a particular model, they did a ton of market research. And when it came out, it wasn't a very successful launch or product. I forgot which model it was. And shocker. This whole, pardon?
Shocker.
Yeah. yeah, truly shocking, isn't it? But that was like, there was, they weren't interpreting, they were just taking feedback and they were just taking that feedback and mulching it into a thing that wasn't focused in any way. So what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, by the way, the iPhone BlackBerry story is fascinating and it's a really great example of this in play. I think it was the new CEO of BlackBerry was convinced that people loved the BlackBerry keyboard. The actual buttons. It's such a mark on the Canadian tech industry. So I remember it quite well. There were some hardcore BlackBerry users, don't get me wrong, but what Steve Jobs got very right was in interpreting and understanding a barrier to entry and understanding customers very, very well. And there was a ton of customer development that was done on that. And he, you know, went the path, the more customer-led path than BlackBerry. BlackBerry, you know, infamously, just the CEO just decided this is what customers wanted. It was, they went polar opposite directions. iPhone went, like Steve Jobs went the customer-led route and BlackBerry went the, nope, we know what's best route. So that's classic. The Henry Ford example, I don't know that much about the Henry Ford market research example. I've participated and been in the receiving end, and I've been in organizations that have done that style of market research, and it can be very, very valuable for certain types of activities. But when it comes to a fundamental understanding of what value your product or solution provides to your best customers, it's very, very different style of research that I'm describing.
Right. I think it's been a great discussion. We're going to go for our mid-break. We will be back in a few moments, folks.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Lifter LMS, the leading learning management system solution for WordPress. If you or your client are creating any kind of online course, training-based membership website, or any type of e-learning project, Lifter LMS is the most secure, stable, well-supported solution on the market. Go to lifterlms.com and save 20% at checkout with coupon code podcast20. That's podcast20. Enjoy the rest of your show.
We're coming back, folks. I just want to point out, we do a fantastic newsletter aimed at the WordPress professional and the somebody building a SaaS. You can sign up for the newsletter, which I personally write every week. It has the stories of the week that I find interesting, a bit of a commentary about SaaS or WordPress, all mixed up in a delicious little bundle just for you. And you can get this newsletter by going over to wp-tonic/newsletter, wp-tonic/newsletter, and sign up for it. It will make my day. There we are. I'm a sad soul if that will make my day, but there we go. When you get to my age, that's all you can look forward to, but there we are. Oh, my God. I've had a warning already. On we go. So, you wrote this book, and I've been told, Rob Rowling, he's a friend of mine. He came on a few months ago to plug his new book, and he's wrote a few, and it's a painful experience. So, so what's a couple, what's been one or two of the reactions that you got from people that have surprised you the most about the book that you didn't envision?
It's a good question. One comes to mind immediately, which is the academic world actually providing feedback, which you almost spit your coffee there.
Obviously, my school experience is actually, I'm the most overeducated dyslexic you've ever met. I've got a degree, I've got an MA, and I've also got an American degree as well. And I hated all of it with a passion. I would never do that again,
I haven't been a student in 20 something years.
I'd rather go to the dentist and have four root canals and engage in high education.
I actually loved university, but that was probably because that was my stage in life. That said, that has been the most surprising response, because we wrote this book to be a very practical how-to guide for somebody who, an in-house practitioner or a founder to read and then pass on to the rest of the team. It's really meant to be a book that gets shared or circulated around an organization, or small teams or bigger teams. Once somebody's bought in, ideally, like the founder reads it and then passes it on to maybe a head of product marketing or a head of product marketing or a marketer or product manager reads it and passes it, on to the founder or the executive team. That was what we sort of wrote it to address, was that, need. And then, of course, if there's people in situations where, like, this sounds great, we don't have the resources to do this, then, they call us up. Great. You can DIY it successfully. There's a whole workbook to do it, or give us a call. What I didn't expect to happen was, like, universities and schools and colleges with asking for permission to use passages in, like, academic materials and course materials. I am not kidding you. Last night, my sister called me to tell me that her friend, who is a librarian at the local college here, was talking with the team about the list of books that they're going to be, the new books that they're introducing to the library at this local college. And she heard my name and recognized my name. She had like complete coincidence that this college that I went to a gajillion years ago is now going to be carrying my book, which is really funny to me that it would be considered something that students would read, when really it was written for, like, people who are, like, in the trenches doing the work. So that was surprising for sure. I'd love it, but it was surprising. I guess the other maybe surprising thing that has happened is I imagined it would be I just read this book, feels really practical, we should be able to do this. And then they hand off one copy of the book. But what's actually started to happen is we get emails about a CEO who's bought 30 copies for the entire team. So that's another.
You will read it, and I want discussion paper on Monday. Your conscience can deal with this.
But these are the people that we hear from. So who knows what's happening with the people that we don't hear from, but these are the people that I, you know, that I've actually heard about. And that's obviously really gratifying as well, because it means it's resonating and feels helpful, which is, I mean, a big guide in writing this book was Rob Fitzpatrick's book, How to Write Useful Books. Another big influence for me was April Dunford's Positioning book. Which was rated.
She's fab. She's been on. I've had a couple of discussions with April. She's fab.
Yeah. I am lucky to say that April's a friend of mine. She has been a huge, huge inspiration to me. That book was a huge inspiration, as was Rob Fitzpatrick's, which was all about being useful. So her positioning book, obviously awesome, very useful, short, concise, to the point. You get what you need from it. Very practical. And so that was a big guiding principle for us when writing the book as well.
I think Rob Rowling's book, which he was kind enough to send me a signed copy of, SAS.
You just said you don't.
The SAS playbook is quite good as well. I've actually read it. I know Kurt studied it in quite some detail.
I have not read it. I should read it. It's on my list. And
I had a quick look through it. It's in front of me, actually. It's quite good, and I religiously listen to Rob's podcast. It's always entertaining, isn't it? Over to you, Kurt.
Well, I just want to kind of piggyback on that. It's I've got two books that I've put out, and I will tell you, I never thought the first one was ever going to sell, Georgiana. Never thought it was going to sell, and then it was in the automotive industry. And Ducati bought the book, and it changed the trajectory of my whole family.
Wow.
Like I pray the same results for you, right? It was like, and then now I'm just in love with it. And one of my Canadian clients actually has a company that helps people publish their first book, WorkingWriters.co. To me, publishing is, regardless of your education level or what academia does with the book, to get those thoughts out and to process it and follow through, the reward is always. Yeah, we stacked up.
It's been incredible. I mean, it came out last May, so it's not quite a year now, and the feedback has been incredible. I am on a lot of calls where the person I'm on a call with, like, physically holds up the book to be like, "So I read it. Now, like, I need you to do this." And that's, you know, I'm in, basically. It's been wild. And
well, what you've said in your previous interviews recently, I think the synopsis, obviously, I'd be interested, you wrote the book, but what I thought the key message was this, right? Yeah, you know, you can tinker with your funnel, you know, the wording, you can set up A/B testing on your funnels. Wake up, you've got a bigger problem. You know, your funnels, tinkering with them might get a temporary improvement, but the reason why your funnels aren't working is you don't really understand the buyer's journey. Basically, you don't have any understanding of why they, in a normally crowded market, and there are the odd situation where your product is so unique or so beneficial, but normally you're in a semi-competitive market. And your product has a certain edge, a certain feature that might hopefully appeals more to your target audience. But normally you need a much better understanding of why the buyer journey and why your customers or possible customers are choosing your product or not. I think that's the fundamental message of the book. Am I correct in any way?
Yes, it is. I would add to it, because, you know, you're 100% right. Far, far too many folks are guessing when they don't need to be guessing. They could be, you know, designing much better customer experience, more highly converting customer experiences, more effective, more scalable customer experiences, by better understanding their customers, gathering this type of, you know, customer intelligence. The thing that I would add is customer research for the sake of customer research often goes nowhere. And the the thing that we want to make sure that we abolish is poorly conducted customer research that gets dusty on a shelf and never actually gets actioned. So that's the sort of antidote, right? So yes, doing customer research, wildly important, but actually actioning that customer research is what's going to make that time investment worth it. And so really operationalizing it for your team, doing that customer experience mapping, identifying those milestones, identifying KPIs to measure your ability to get a customer from one milestone to the next. That is what's going to mobilize your team to build an actual scale.
And that's why you developed the blueprint part of the book.
That's the framework. Yeah.
Framework.
This is the step-by-step process. You have to, you know, there's like the getting buy-in internally. If you're on a larger team, there's getting your team together of who's going to be involved and the key stakeholders to make sure that this thing gets championed forward. That's a bigger company issue. But then there's actually how to conduct the research, what to ask, how to parse and identify those patterns that I was talking about earlier, and then how to take that understanding of the customer and map it across a customer experience map where you really understand the sort of leaps of faith that your customer takes in their relationship with you. And if you have a software product, you're at a unique advantage where you can actually measure your ability to help customers get from one step to the next by their meaningful product usage. And that can be wildly helpful for improving your trial to pay conversion rates or your free to pay conversion rates, let alone retention or identifying. This is like where, you know, this is like the 201 is like where your customer becomes inactive or stops using your product in a meaningful way. And you can be proactive in reaching out to them to help get them back on track. You can do that during product onboarding, but you can also do that during the continued value stage of your customer's experience. So it enables you to do a lot better, like more effective customer experience, but also at scale, which obviously is very useful for anybody running a recurring revenue business like SaaS or membership or things like that.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I'll back over to you, Kurt, and answer the next question.
Well, I'm hoping it's an easier question or answer, especially after AI's been out for the last couple of years now, but at least at this level. What do you think AI is going to do with funnel building and customer needs research and junk like that for the next 18 months or so?
I think what it's going to do is further polarize the good from the bad. So the people that are relying on AI too much are just going to float to the bottom and it's going to be very obvious and they're going to fail. And I say leverage AI too much. Obviously, there's a lot to talk about what that means.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of ways to leverage AI in really smart ways. And I think it can go a long way. If we're talking about building a funnel experience, that's one thing. If we're talking about AI for customer research, different discussion. AI for customer research, I tread very lightly there. The reason being that NLPs are incapable of measuring energy in a conversation. And so these conversations that you have with your customers where you're asking them about what was going on in your world, you know, what was hard about that and what were your anxieties and it takes a human being to understand where the different energy sits in that conversation to then, after that conversation is over, really think about what was actually meant and what that experience actually felt like for that person. AI isn't capable of doing that today. I have a hard time believing it's going to happen anytime soon. NLPs are great, but like I said, they're not capable of that human understanding quite yet. They can do a ton, though, to help with parsing the research after the fact, layering on top of what a human being is capable of understanding. It can help with operationalizing the voice of customer and pulling voice of customer out of transcripts and things like that. It can help with creating charts and communicating the insights back to teams. There's a lot that AI can do to support research. But I don't think it's going to be anytime soon before it's replacing the customer interview process, just because that is such a human experience that I don't think it's capable of. In terms of building funnel experiences, sure, there's a ton that can be done, especially if you're building like a custom GPT, for example, that can get really familiar with your voice and tone. You can arm it with customer intel, then maybe, using AI or a custom GPT to help you in crafting, email copy and things like that. That can be really effective, but you've got to arm it with the right intel. But that's true of anything, right? Like, you can't just ask an AI to write a blog post for you and expect it to be good. And that's what I meant about the, like, the polarization between good and bad. That's going to become more obvious, I think, over time, as more people rely on AI in, like, crappy ways versus smart ways, where they're just tapping into it to facilitate, you know, parts of their process versus the, like, strategic level process.
Yeah. I mean, just in my own experience, I'm getting, you know, five to eight spam messages a day about some new fantastic AI platform that I need to say goodbye to ChatGPT for, you know? And it just seems like there's, to your point, there's going to be like this attraction that pulls lazy people, you know, into a pool of mediocrity, right? And then the expert will have a chance to shine.
That's exactly right. We've looked into a lot of like customer research, because for us, for our internal processes, the customer research is the highest lift, right? It's the most intensive. And because it's the most intensive, it's the most costly to our business. So we're always looking for ways to optimize. And there's a lot of tools that promise the ability to interpret interviews, video and audio or transcripts. I've tried all of them. And I don't even want to say I've tried all of them. My head researcher, my lead strategist, who's like the most experienced researcher that I've ever worked with, she's tried them and she's like, they do not fulfill their promises. And that's the case for a lot of different AI tools. And it is the same with research as well, like interviews.
It's fascinating that she must have read my mind, because, you know, if you listen to Startup This Week in Startups, Jason, you know, he salivates at the next business to business internal intelligence startup. Or you listen to Professor exactly. And then but then if you listen to Professor G's podcast, you know, it's riddled with IBM adverts for the latest suite of AI tools that will tell you everything about your customer, isn't it? They're really pushing this narrative, aren't they? Hard.
Somebody created, it was really cool, these avatars of different types of customers. It's mostly for B2C. And I think it's four different avatars of individuals that represent four different, again, avatars of what your potential customer might look like. Again, B2C. So very different scenario here. But you as a marketer can go to this avatar, this AI, and ask it questions like, what do you think of this? And, you know, if provide me feedback on this experience. And it's an AI created avatar that is not your customer, has not experienced your product or solution at all, is just a generically created avatar that is, especially in a B2C scenario, I could see it being like, you know, a very low-hanging fruit way to collect really superficial feedback, which could be very valuable as a starting point. But when we're talking about B2B and a more complex problems and a scenario where you're asking somebody to make a pretty significant shift in like their work life, let alone budget and things like that, your customer is totally different than your, you know, the folks that you may be in a mastermind with. Like, you have a completely different target customer. You have a completely different offering. You have a completely different team with a different set of skill sets. And so trying to, you know, rely on the best practices or the playbooks of others will get you into a lot of trouble. And that's what AI is basically doing. It's giving you access to other people's playbooks instead of looking at your own solution, your own customers, your own team.
Yeah. On the other hand, I think that there's two responses to what you just said that occurred to me. I think when AI, pattern recognition and ability to do large data sets, obviously Facebook and Meta have utilized that technology to dig themselves out of a big hole with Apple and become highly successful again. So pattern recognition and taking a lot of data and seeing new patterns, and that, great. I think the other factor is, this is more based on philosophy, is there's a big difference between intelligence and wisdom. I think there's a lot of emphasis on the intelligence, but I I'm not the sharpest tool, but I'm not the bluntest tool in the toolbox. But I have mixed with a lot of very highly intelligent people, but a lot of them have absolutely no wisdom about anything. Zero wisdom.
I agree with you. Talk to me more about the connection to AI.
Well, that might be my dyslexic mind, because there isn't really. But I think it really gives the impression of intelligence. You know, that's why a lot of people, though, a few Google engineers think it's alive, it's conscious. Mm. As far as I'm concerned, it's what's the name of that? The Mechanical Turk. It's Electronic Mechanical Turk. That chess playing machine in the 17th century, and it was just a small person underneath that was playing the chess. But like, it's got that kind of feel to it, but what it isn't. So it gives the impression of intelligence, and it can write things and it does the job, but people think it's conscious. So it's got wisdom. It's got absolutely no wisdom about anything.
Yep.
Well, I think there is some connection. Would you agree, or do you think I'm just morphing it?
No, I think you're 100% right. I think it's a tool, and people should be remembering that it's a tool and not conscience. I think you're probably spot on. Again, I think AI is going to be very, very valuable and very helpful as a tool that is in your tool set. And thinking about how to leverage it is what is going to be the name of the game. Having it, you know, thinking that it can do everything for you or replace a human, I think is the mistake that some people are making, because there are bad actors in the space, right? Like, hey, this is why marketers can't have nice things, because there are people who are going to be out in the world just bastardizing the use of AI to the point of like,
well, they already are. Now you're in some-
totally.
I think the big question in the next 18 months, 2 years, or a little bit longer, maybe 5 years, who knows, is the whole concept of general intelligence.
Yeah.
But even that, which is a totally different subject to what we're seeing at the present moment, is that even if that happened, it doesn't mean intelligence, not wisdom. They're two complete, in my perspective, two completely different scenarios. So let's move on to my last and most favourite question. So if you had your own time machine, you know, H.G. Wells, the great author, and you could go back to the beginning, the early days of your career, Jujinda, is there one or two things you wish you could say to yourself that, you know, little insights, little nudges that you could tell the younger Jujinda that would help you avoid some of the arrows in the back and some of the painful experiences that we all have to go through?
For sure. The one that comes immediately to mind...
Not coming on this podcast?
My younger self, much, much younger self from an hour ago. The one that immediately comes to mind was when I was at peak stress in my career in-house and in feeling like I had to prove myself and in feeling like, you know, that there was so much at stake and that the success of the company that I was working for was riding on me, which was completely false, but was, you know, self-inflicted. I operate, and I say this in the book, this is actually how the book begins. I was operating like a chicken with its head cut off. I was so desperate to prove value. I was in love with my team, and I was in love with the company and our solution and what we could do, to the point where I was desperate to make an impact. You know, under promise, over deliver type. And so all I did was work, and I didn't have any children at the time, thank goodness, but I worked a lot harder at things I shouldn't have been working so hard at, which was like executing and pumping out campaigns and ideas and brainstorming and being really, and I'm a very strategic person by nature, but being too tactical for my own good, because I was desperate to hit my targets and prove that, you know, I was doing my job and you know, being as effective as I could. What I later realized was I didn't have to be doing so much guessing. I should have been relying on where the truth lies with these, in these cases where your amazing best customers, those who are getting value from you today, have a lot of answers inside of their heads that you just need to pull out and sort of to unlock a lot of opportunities to then test in your customer experience or your product experience. And I wish I had learned sooner that that was a resource that was available to me. I would have made way better decisions. I would have been much more effective in my role. Don't get me wrong, we did great. I introduced customer journey mapping and the KPIs, and I had that whole experience, which was really, really effective. But I wish I'd known that I could arm that customer experience that we were designing with more customer data to inform it. And it would have made my job a lot easier, and I would have been able to empower my team to operate without relying on me so much, and just to be able to be more effective. So I was way too stressed out, thought the world was on my shoulders, when actually I had a lot more answers at my disposal than I realized. That's my go-to forevermore. That's one of the easiest regrets to sort of cite when I get asked this question.
Yeah, perfect example, listeners of yours, of intelligence and wisdom. There we go. So what's the best way for people to find out more about yourself and also the book? My co-host had to disappear.
Okay, Scott,
no, he did give me, I apologize. He did warn me that he had to go off.
No problem. So the best way to find the book is really to go to forgetthefunnel.com. It's right there in the top nav. You'll see book and you can find the link there. It's obviously also on Amazon. You just search Forget the Funnel. We have a podcast. It's very new and baby. We're nowhere. I think we're at episode 12.
Just a tiny,
little dog.
Not even a toddler.
It's exactly. Very, very baby. And those podcast episodes are available on YouTube as well. But I'm on LinkedIn. So that's an easy place to get in touch with me if anybody wants to ask questions or, challenge or get in touch. LinkedIn's probably the most direct.
I really enjoyed the conversation. Hopefully, maybe sometime later on in the year or in next year, you'll agree to come back on the show. I've really enjoyed the discussion. Also, I just want to point out WordPress professionals and SaaS people. If you're looking to host your WordPress membership website or learning management or community website, or you've got some websites already, why don't you look at becoming a partner with WP Tonic? We've got some fabulous packages for you, the WordPress professional. You can find out more about this by going to wp-tonic/partners, wp-tonic.com/partners. And you can book a quick chat with me, and we'd love you to become a partner with WP Tonic. It's been a fab interview. We've got a great round table show next week. Got a great couple special panelists joining the normal crew of panelists, and we will be taking the mickey out of all the monthly tech stories and WordPress drama. It's going to be a fab show, more of my English humor, or I call it humor. Please join us for that. We'll see you soon, folks. Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening. We really do appreciate it. Why not visit the Mastermind Facebook group, and also to keep up with the latest news, click wp-tonic.com/newsletter. We'll see you next time.